Welcome to the Smart Green Energy Transition Podcast. This is a Smarter Grid Solutions production and is our contribution to the search for impactful solutions to the climate challenge. This podcast will focus on smart decentralised energy solutions, a crucial but underreported part of the net zero carbon transition. We'll explore topics such as decentralised renewable energy developments, smart grid integration solutions, the required system flexibility, customer empowerment, community enablement and local energy markets. We've timed this podcast to coincide with COP26, which is happening in the Smarter Grid Solutions hometown of Glasgow.
I'm Ben Curley.
And I'm Graham Ault.
And today we're looking at the role community organisations can play in the clean energy transition. We are joined by Mari Brooks, Executive Director at Low Carbon Hub, a leading community energy organisation in the UK.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
For listeners who aren't familiar with Low Carbon Hub, perhaps you could give a little introduction as to what it is you guys do. And in particular, the community aspect of your organisation is really what's fascinating for us.
Low Carbon Hub operates around 50-odd community energy projects in Oxfordshire. And that's mostly rooftop PV projects. We've got one battery installed now, and we also operate hydro generation on the Thames at Sanford at the Weir there. We're kind of rooted in community leadership. So the model that we use, our kind of core operations, was developed by communities in Oxfordshire, and we have taken that and scaled it up so that we can make more happen locally than individual community groups could do on their own. And we continue to support those organisations. So our core operations is developing and operating renewable generation assets. We raise a lot of our investment from community investors, much of it local to the projects, although you don't have to be living right next door to invest. There's an economic return locally from what we do, and then we are selling our energy often to our host landlords. So we have lots of school rooftops where we're then selling that electricity to the school. So they're getting a benefit in terms of having clean, discounted energy over the period of that contract.
That's terrific. It's that community focus that kind of sets Low Carbon Hub apart from the more traditional model and how stakeholders in the community engage with the topic. I think what we're really keen to discuss on the podcast is the motivations that bring you personally to this field, both with your colleagues in the hub, but more just generally in terms of the sector itself. You know, what is it that motivates you about climate change, about the energy transition, and where does that motivation stem from in your background?
Probably common to a lot of people working in this kind of area, valuing the environment's obviously personally really important to me. You know, I grew up in a house where my dad was the one who was like, right, we're going to get the energy efficient light bulbs. I mean, they're still there and they take 15 minutes to warm up as far as I can remember. That has always been part of my life and something that's been important to me. So actually, in terms of finding a job and a career, it was always going to be something, making a contribution towards that. I think the other thing, if I'm totally honest, is that I really like a challenge, which is quite a good motivator in this field because there's a lot of complexity. But I do kind of personally love being in the thick of that, trying to cut through all the complexity and the uncertainty and just finding ways to make progress. For me, that's motivating, but I suppose in some ways it's important for anyone working in this field, but that's not demotivating because it is just the nature of the challenge in front of us about how complicated it all is.
When you're talking about your motivations there, you talked about, you know, earlier in life and then what your job is now. How do you think you layered on different elements of professionalising, you know, working yourself into a career in clean energy?
That's an interesting one because I didn't start out working in sustainability. I actually started out as an academic. So I studied physics as an undergraduate, did a PhD in astronomy. And then I spent a couple of years doing research in the States as an astronomer. It's interesting you ask that because it is really connected to the decision. And basically, one of the other things that motivates me is lifestyle, which I think a lot of people would find surprising given that I do tend to pick roles that are quite tough and involve lots of hard work and all the rest of it. But actually, that kind of career path wasn't working for me anymore. Like, you don't really get much choice about where you work. There's not very many jobs in astronomy. And so when I was looking to do something else, it was kind of really the prompt to make the change was that I didn't want to keep moving around. I wanted to find some place where I could kind of be a bit more stable. And so I decided I'd switch careers to achieve that. And so choosing going into something about environmental sustainability was just the obvious thing at that point. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I did a master's in environmental technology at Imperial, which was just fantastic. I mean, on the technical side of things, having done physics before, I kind of knew a lot of the background, or it was like fairly familiar to me. It wasn't a super technical course, but it was a real deep dive in a year into a lot of energy policy work. So did that, worked in a startup environment on the carbon footprinting on a cloud-based system, so relevant to what I do now. And then spent 3 years in central government at what was then the Department of Energy and Climate Change. And then I made yet another decision to improve my lifestyle and stop commuting into London and moved here to Oxford and just landed on my feet, because the project that I landed on was to work at Oxford City Council and do the project management for a whole load of EU funding that had just come in. Part of that EU funding was essentially what you could see as being the startup investment for the low carbon hub. That wasn't everything that I did at the City Council. I was there for quite a lot longer, but I had that real beginning here in Oxford that got me into that community side of things. And yeah, now here I am working at the hub as their Smart Energy Systems Director.
Fascinating. We'll come back to the smart energy systems part of that, I'm sure, through our discussion. And I think also it'll be massively motivating and illuminating for a number of people to hear the different points and transitions through your career as well, and how you've ended up doing something as important as you are today.
Thanks, Graham. So, Mary, you've obviously described your journey there, the steps that you've taken, somewhat circuitous route, but you found yourself at the Low Carbon Hub. It's an incredible organisation. We've learned a little bit from working with you, some of the things that you're involved with, but how would you summarise the organisation's mission and what sets it apart when you're trying to address the climate challenge and some of the ways that you're doing? Is there something that you would highlight as what makes the Low Carbon Hub stand out?
Sure. Well, I mean, at a high level, we're basically out to prove that we can all meet our energy needs in a way that's good for people and good for the planet. So, you know, in a nutshell, that is that's what we're about. We've got kind of core operations that are built around a portfolio of renewable energy projects here in Oxfordshire. Well, I think, you know, on one hand, one of the things that stands us out is how rooted in community leadership we are. And as I say, that's not just the history of how this kind of business model and the way we're set up works, but it's also that we've retained really close links with communities across Oxfordshire. We continue to help to support them in running their own projects, or if there's new community groups springing up, then, you know, we can point them in the right directions or connect them up with other people who can help. And that's all part of our, you know, community benefit mission. We're running these energy generation projects, so you get the direct benefit of the clean energy and the kind of economic side of things. But the other side of the business is that we work on innovation, and community is really at the heart of that. So yes, helping them to set up their own projects and so on and so forth, as I mentioned. But actually, my main focus in my role is a really big part of this innovation thing. And that is work that we're doing as partners on an SSEN-led project called Project Leo. And I think it's a really good example of how we are also working on the innovative side, where the goal is to accelerate the decarbonisation of our economy in Oxfordshire. And that means, you know, we're doing some things that will benefit us, that will maybe change how we run our portfolio. And that's all very exciting. I can tell you lots about that in terms of smart energy systems. But the point is that we might learn things that actually we decide we're not going to take forwards, but somebody else will. And we work with local partners, so we're all in it together. And so we're driving that change across Oxfordshire, whether it's purely about us or whether actually it's about the whole system.
That's fantastic. And I think what point that you touched on there, which is key, as we talk about the goals that will be coming out of COP26 at the high level, the macro level, there's going to be some ambitious agendas. But how are these things going to be implemented? It's going to be by a diverse alliance of organisations on the ground. And with that project that you mentioned, Project Leo, am I correct in saying you're working with a variety of different stakeholders from across the piece? So it's not just in one niche, it's across the board and different types of organisations as well?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So there's parts of that that are kind of about us looking at how we can make our portfolio basically the smartest community energy portfolio in the world, because you've got to aim high, right? But actually, some of the projects that we're running that are closely related to those are ones where we have deliberately worked with volunteer groups in different communities around Oxfordshire and asked them what was important about their energy system and what they wanted to get from it and what their goals were. So in the case of one of our community groups that's in rural Oxfordshire, they're not connected to the gas grid, and a lot of the people there are on really expensive kind of oil-fueled heating. That was about decarbonising their heating, moving to heat pumps. And Project Leo is about smart local energy systems. So we've been able to help them by saying, right, there's kind of some nuts and bolts of what you need to think about in terms of getting those installations made. But, you know, we can also take that a step further and ask, well, if you were to operate your heating in a flexible way and be willing to, you know, let somebody else have a little bit of control within limits, obviously, then maybe we can achieve more as a group of households than anybody acting alone. So they'll definitely get their clean energy. And there's a lot of reason to believe that in those cases, especially because of the move from oil, that that's going to work out well from a cost perspective anyway. But actually, we are now looking at how you take these heat pumps that can be controlled remotely already, but saying, well, if we pull that all together in one platform, maybe acting as a community, we can actually do more to manage our energy, our use of our energy, than we would each be able to do alone. And that bit of the project is what we call the People's Power Station, which we're developing to try things out like that with communities and also to integrate our own portfolio and operate our rooftop PV and our battery and our hydro in a way that makes the best use of the system we've got right now.
That sounds absolutely fascinating, Mary, and the People's Power Station. Presumably that's something that is already scaling and can scale further.
We're definitely still in the early stages of doing that. So we have been accessing the data from key Pathfinder assets, so one of our rooftop PVs or battery, trying to work on optimizing and remote control of our hydro. So we're just kind of getting those first few case studies done and working and going through trials with those, which is part of the work that we're doing with SSEN and the various smart energy systems trials that they're running. So it is still early days, and there's challenges as well, because we've got an existing portfolio that's, you know, in the ground already. It's already been commissioned, it's up and running, it's operational. And actually just getting the kind of on-site hardware and the data side of things working is therefore a challenge, because it's not been designed in from the beginning. And also we're doing something quite new in terms of the scale that we operate at, because they're all, relatively speaking, they're smaller systems. We're not talking about absolutely giant ground-mounted PV in most cases. We have one of those. So they are comparatively small systems, but we think that's important because there are a lot of numbers flying around about the amount of kind of the value to our energy system and the ability to optimize how we're using it to allow us to decarbonize it, right? Like the whole context for this is that we're looking at electrification of transport, electrification of heat in the next 10 to 15 years, and all of that happens together. How on earth do we get all of those things powered? And does it mean that we need to keep building lots of pylons, or can we actually just find a smarter way to use the infrastructure that we've already got? So that's why we think it's important, because this is part of the infrastructure that we've already got. And if we can do something with our existing portfolio, then so can everybody else. Out to prove that we can meet our energy needs in that way. So but definitely at the beginning of the journey on that.
You've described quite a lot of the ingredients in, you know, getting some success and, you know, getting really good proof points, some great projects underway. How big a part of, you know, a totally clean energy system can community energy become then? You know, there's the different classes of technology, scales of assets. Clearly this is a number of smaller groups, but presumably it can scale countrywide, worldwide in lots of different ways. How big can it become?
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. And it's huge elsewhere as well. I don't want to pretend that kind of Oxfordshire is the centre of this. There's lots of projects around the UK, and there's a really big movement in community energy across Europe as well. I'm sure beyond that, although I'm less familiar with wider reaches of it as a movement. In terms of scale, it's kind of what people want, actually. as I said, a lot of our rooftop assets are, in kind of energy sector terms, quite small, potentially less than 30 kilowatt peak, if you, for listeners who know what that means. Not huge. But as I said, we are just moving into our first larger scale ground-mounted solar farm, and that's 19 megawatts. And I am not going to do that maths in my head right now, but, you know, considerably larger. And so we've been able to cover off quite a difference in scale there. At 19 megawatts, I mean, that's larger and comparable and larger than many of the big so-called commercial solar farms. So, you know, there's nothing small about community energy necessarily. I think the other thing is that it helps when you really are rooted locally because of the trust. So there are projects that community energy can make happen that nobody else is going to be able to. From a community energy perspective, we and others see value in projects that perhaps wouldn't make it onto the list for somebody else's pipeline, particularly the smaller scale rooftop projects. We see the value in that because we might well know, in the case of a school, for example, it's a nice, easy one to describe, you know who's benefiting from that. But whether it's a school or a local business or whoever it is, there's a connection there with the people who actually are hosting that, who are going to use the energy, and their presence within the community. That kind of nudges things across the line. And I think also for an organisation where it's not their core purpose to get solar panels on their roof, although they can see why it's a nice idea, it can be a lot of work potentially for them to work out how to do it, find their suppliers, all that kind of stuff. And there's other things that they can do with their time, especially in the case of schools. But, you know, with businesses, they've got other things that actually they've got to crack on with whatever it is that they produce or sell or their services. And so they can see the value in working with an organisation that is really rooted in the local community because that's part of what they want to do as well. It kind of wins out on both sides of the equation there in a way that it just never would for other developers.
As a representative of a community organisation, if someone in the policy arena was listening to this and there were one or two things that would really make a big help to enabling organisations like yourself on the ground trying to implement and deliver clean energy solutions, what are the kind of coordinating or framework improvements that could really make a big difference?
Recognising the length of the journey that we're on. So taking the example of Project Leo, which was originally a 3-year programme. It's now 4 years extended because of the kind of delays and challenges after COVID. But actually, 4 years is not long enough to address this kind of agenda. What we've discovered is that there's so many things to deal with in terms of trying to shift not just the technical and infrastructure sides of our energy system, but then to look at what does that mean? Or, you know, how do we bring our imagination to the table at this point before the infrastructure gets kind of fixed in and invested in? How do we bring our imagination to the table and make things that are really socially desirable and commercially viable and get making the most of the system that we want? And so some of those barriers are around, for example, like the funding, the government funding for Project Leo has really helped with. We have been able to do an enormous amount and we're getting an enormous amount of learning out of it. But it's not going to be over at the end. We'll have got a certain way forward. And what we'll have discovered is that we now know better the kinds of questions that still need to be answered and go away on us. So I think that we need to see continued support for that kind of innovation funding, whether it's research and development end of things or commercial pull to market type initiatives. There is a huge role to play for local government in what's going on. They are often the kind of coordinators and, you know, the kind of strategic organisations who are well placed to make connections and join the dots at an implementation level. But what we've seen in the past has often been government funding that was focused on capital spend and equipment and doesn't recognise that just that sheer level of work that has to be done. Local governments or other kinds of organisations, I would say, like the Low Carbon Hub, but, you know, equally local enterprise partnerships, other organisations such as universities that have a real strong long-term interest in the place that they're based in. So there's other organisations that can do this, but that have that well-placed local networking organisations who can bring people together and do the work locally is really important. And so I think that needs to be supported. And I think actually if you do that, then if you've got someone in a community, but it's an individual, a business, whoever it is, a group, who's saying, I want to do something, what can I do? or how do I choose between X, Y, and Z, then you need to have that social infrastructure in place to support them. I think we do very well at it in Oxfordshire, but we certainly struggle to maintain that. And we've managed it through creating the hub in some respects on community energy. But I'm sure there's a whole load of range of wider kind of sustainability issues where it's more of a struggle. And so, yeah, supporting getting the work done and recognising how much work there is in there that's needed to turn the technological solutions and into commercial solutions and especially into socially desirable ones that people actually want to have, because now's the time to find out what people want. It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's hard to make a really big, massive systemic change like this, but it's not very much harder to make two or three changes at the same time. You know, if you're trying to do something impossible, you might as well try and do three impossible things at the same time and come up with the absolutely best result you can.
We're going to move on now. We've got a few quick-fire questions to put to you to find out a bit more about what you think about these different solutions and the way we're going to solve the climate challenge. Big wind or small local solar as the real solution?
Both. Can I have both?
Definitely.
Excellent.
Extinction Rebellion or Committed Insider?
For me, Committed Insider. But that's not to say I don't want Extinction Rebellion to be there.
Hydrogen or electric for your next car?
Electric. Absolutely electric. We need the hydrogen for other things.
Battery, heat pump or EV charger next for your home improvements?
EV charger.
Regulatory carrot or a policy stick to make things happen in this kind of vision of cleaner, smarter local energy that we've been talking about?
Who's designing it? If I get to design it, stick actually, I reckon. If someone else is designing it, carrot.
Government action or free market solutions?
There's no such thing as a free market. Government intervention every day of the week.
And this final question then is the classic, if we can be friends after this. So big physical infrastructure or smart, digital, flexible solutions to enable the clean energy transition?
Smart, digital, flexible.
Probably, like the first question, there's a range of things required. I'm trying to be fair now, having pitched this question with really self-serving intent. You know, of course, there needs to be a balance. There's no one magic answer, is there?
Well, it's true, but also one of the things that I've been interested to understand better since being involved in the smart energy systems world is that even if it's inevitable that you need to invest in kind of big infrastructure, if you can delay that, it reduces the cost. Let's make the best use of what we've got until we really, really need to invest in something bigger, and then we'll make the right investment at the right time.
Great. Knowing who Smarter Grid Solutions are and our distributed energy resource management systems that we produce, we are a partner, so this is full disclosure, we are a part of a LEO project that's being described here. What advice would you have for us, you know, knowing what we do, what should we be doing to help clean energy transition more?
Well, I mean, vested interest answer as well then. But actually, I think the thing that we see value in is accessing all that flexibility in existing assets, and that includes some of the smaller ones. And, you know, as you guys know well, one of the real challenges there is going in and getting the kind of kit in the ground and working out how to get the data from something that's already in place. And so I think although there's many aspects to that challenge that are going to be outside of your control, I mean, actually, there's an example of where policy intervention would be very helpful, is around data and who owns it. Because at the moment, if you're putting a metering system in, you in a lot of ways don't really have that much control over how you access your data and what kind of format it comes in and how much of it you're getting. So there's a policy ask. But I suppose from the point of view of your systems, actually, what's going to be hugely valuable from our perspective and kind of from that scaling up perspective is if we can really crack this nut of how we are able to make existing generation assets flexible and therefore make it more accessible to participate in whatever new markets and services or kind of local ways of using energy are developed by us and by others.
Oh, that's super. Thank you very much for that. Well, that's been a fascinating discussion in many ways. One thing I'm thinking at the end of that, though, is if I were a small local community organisation and I was looking to participate in some new smart bit of the market where somebody was willing to offer some value or use my data in a new way or come up with some new business model, that would probably be quite daunting. So I guess I want to know if you've any learning from the project you've been in or any thoughts about how do we scale this so that genuinely the energy system and all the actors empower individuals, small organisations, the full spectrum of participants in this smart new energy system. What's required to allow all of those organisations to participate fully?
You're right. It is a bit of a minefield in some ways. It's certainly complicated and there's a lot to navigate. And as a small organisation that's kind of tempted to bite that off and chew it, it is quite difficult. So we kind of, I can immediately think to some of the things that we've learned that we will, obviously, as a publicly funded project anyway, would expect to be sharing, and we will try and share as far and wide as we can, is around the different kind of what we've hoped will become new business models for investing in local clean energy and making use of being able to do that flexibly in order to make those projects investable. Whether we succeed in that, or actually if we discover things are a bit more complicated and there's other barriers to address, then we'll certainly be sharing that as a project at LEO. Another thing I think that it's not surprising really, but I don't think we anticipated how much work there was to be done in communicating about smart energy systems. Just finding the words to share what we're learning is actually quite difficult across even a relatively expert or sector audience, let alone wider than that. And you've got to think that, you know, because there are key organisations like local government and landowners and so on and so forth, we do need to make this accessible to people. And so that's going to be a really big challenge to overcome as well. As I've mentioned, access to data is one of the things that we've struggled with. Actually, I think there's multiple areas in which that is going to be something that we're going to have to work on kind of as a nation, as a society, as the world. You know, one of them is kind of around regulated data in the energy system. Who's allowed to access that? How is it protected? How are individuals protected in terms of their data? But also, how do you get ownership over your own data and do what you want with that and make use of it? And you can see that from a very kind of processy, organisational, regulatory perspective, and that will be necessary. But equally, because we're working with communities, what we're seeing is it really comes up for people. People are concerned about the fact that they can see their energy data is something that may well be accessed in a new way or have new relevance. But actually, your energy profile for your house says quite a lot about you and how you live. So there's concerns about that. And it's not like there's a huge amount of trust necessarily in large organisations managing that kind of data. It also begins to touch on things like cybersecurity, which, you know, we've kind of the trials and the things that we're running, we're kind of protecting from that level of things just by the scale that we're at and not making things easily accessible to the outside world necessarily. But actually, the bigger it gets and the more people you want to involve, then it's not just who's seeing your data and who has access to it in a way that you're giving them permission to do, but what happens if someone gets into that who doesn't have permission and what could they do with that? So that's a whole other world. And I think we've looked at all of these aspects of technological, commercial and social sides of the innovation of what we're doing in Project LEO. We could have spent the same amount of money and time looking at a tenth of one of those. And we certainly discovered all sorts of nuances. So there's loads to be done. And it's kind of why I say it's not a 3 or 4 year project. Like, it's the best part of a decade to really get over a lot of these things and make them work for us.
That is incredibly interesting. And I imagine from what you're saying there, if this is a climate decade and we've got to make all these transitions in the coming decades, you know, it's got to be a process of continual innovation, learning, disseminating those learnings, giving access to data and empowerment and giving opportunities to all the participants in the emerging energy system. So, yeah, there's an awful lot to do beyond any of our, you know, even though they're headline and special to us, projects that are ongoing now.
It's really true. But I think, you know, if you want hope in that, because it can feel like too much of a challenge, actually, there are amazing people doing amazing things on the ground. It's not just in the energy sector. Watching one of these documentaries in telly, and they were kind of showcasing things that people are doing across like biodiversity and all the rest of it. And actually, it really lifted me up, because it's like, yes, there are lots of people doing really good things. We've got the ability to deal with this.
Genuinely a groundswell, and the numbers and opinion polls are supporting that. The people who are now informed and motivated and becoming active to do something real, I think that's a real sign of hope, as you say.
Well, thank you, Mary, for that really exciting and interesting discussion. We've learned a lot today, and it's really inspiring to see and hear about the work that you guys have been doing at Low Carbon Hub. Thanks very much for your time.
Yes, thank you, Mary.
It's been an absolute delight. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Smart Green Energy Transition podcast. Our guest was Mary Brooks, Executive Director at Low Carbon Hub. The presenters were Graham Ault and Ben Curley. The producer was Natasha Barbieri. Until next time, thanks for listening.